How would you like to get up before an audience of 4 million people and introduce yourself? Would you rap on the edge of a glass with a spoon to get attention, like this? Do you think that would quiet such an audience? Would you clear your throat like this? Or would you try to ride over their various noises by shouting through a public address system the traditional salutation?
Ladies and gentlemen!
Suppose some of your audience were playing bridge, and others were arguing, and still others were lying down reading newspapers. Would that terrify you? It wouldn't me, I know. Except that at this moment, when I am addressing 4 million people, and thousands of them are playing bridge and talking across my voice and riding in automobiles and reading things, I'm not at all terrified. That's because there are 4 bare walls of a radio studio around me, and I cannot see your faces. I cannot see 100,000 cigarettes light up in the dark across 8 million square miles of curving continents. And so it becomes relatively easy to introduce myself to perfect strangers. For seclusion has an etiquette all its own. Therefore, I will now do so. After a token sound to separate this informal prologue from a formal introduction. Thank you. From Hollywood, the Columbia Workshop presents me, Dale Thundergard, in a treatise for solar voice entitled The Anatomy of Sound, written and directed by Norman Corwin as program number 18 in the series 26 by Corwin. Now, how shall we anatomize sound for you? With formulas and scientific talk? Well, hardly. To us, you see, a sound wave is a sound wave. What do we care if the intensity of a sound varies directly as the square of the amplitude of the vibration? Let the Bell Laboratories worry about that. We are concerned tonight with the anatomy of common sound. Your sound and my sound and everybody's sound. Because sound is common. And let's not forget that. In fact, let's talk about it. The unpatented, royalty-free, public domain sound made by beasts and wind and rain and crickets and dynamite. After all, our lives are full of sounds and furies signifying everything from the coming of dawn, as in the cockcrow, to the coming of doom, as in the tolling of a sexton's bell, as in Gray's Elegy. Come to think of it, poets would have had a dreary time in a soundproof world. For then they could never have carried on about ignorant armies clashing by night, Matthew Arnold, or about tintinnabulation of the bell, 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 Paul. Nor could there possibly be any moaning at the bar, Tennyson. And what would it have availed friends, Romans, and countrymen to lend their ears? Shakespeare. Sound is always with us, late and soon, and all our days can easily be traced by ear. There is such a thing as average sound in people's lives, and it's a very simple matter to log a day's career in decibels. For example now, the average American's day might sound like this. First, reveling. Then, having drilled a tunnel through your sleep, you rise and break your fast. And while you read your paper, observing that the fires of the world are spreading quietly, quickly toward your feet and number, the coffee smugly percolates. The toaster jumps up with the news that a slice of bread has just been toasted. And having done away with the toast and coffee, off you go to work. Through at least one door. Downstairs, unless you live below street level, in which case, upstairs. And then you walk along the street, whistling in the light for a change. Until you come to the corner where you catch a bus. Boarding it, you drop your hard-earned coin into a coin box. And hanging from a strap, ride a moderate distance, and then arrive at work, and punch a clock, then sit at your machine, and rattle off the morning. Then the proud announcement of the sun, in spite of everything, has reached meridian again. And so to lunch, and back to work, and so 5:30. And you step into the delicatessen on the way home and buy a quart of milk and some pickles. And then home at last, and the key in the lock. And then evening, spent how you will. And then you wind the alarm clock. And so, to bed. Ah. Those are the ordinary sounds. Footsteps and doorknobs turned, and typewriters and dishes, and the sounds of brushing teeth, and autos starting up in low gear. But sound can be romantic, too. It's a matter of association, or of escape, or even of pitch alone. Take, for instance, that alarm clock. Now, there's a mean and ordinary little sound, and yet it rules your life, and is the first thing that you hear each day. But just suppose your bed were in a London tower, and you set Big Ben for 7. You would waken as a hero wakens, and go forth to epic deeds. You'd ride off on a white Arabian charger, instead of a bus. And you'd punch not clocks, but dragons. Or take that factory whistle which blew noon a while back. There's another dull and unimaginative sound. But whistles can be more romantic than a full moon in Titan. Listen. There she blows. A great liner bound for Cathay, bound for Singapore, bound for Philadelphia, bound for any place that will take you away from the routine. Do you argue that it's not the idea of escape which makes a ship's whistle romantic, but the suggestion of luxury, of salons and lounges and tea on deck and officers in white uniforms? Oh, nonsense. Here's another romantic whistle, without any possible association of evening gowns or black ties. That's the whistle of a night freight, hauling a miscellaneous load of grimy boxcars, with a caboose rattling along at the end of a parade. That's locomotive number 7941, watched over by the blazing constellations in the night sky. And a little man named Regan, who sits in the dispatcher's office in Kansas City. That's another whistle. A passenger train, rushing across the fields from some place or other to some other place. That's the sound you heard when you sat up all night with your fellow on the front porch. It was the eastbound express, tearing through town at 4 a.m. with a cargo of sleeping travelers, snatching up mailbags at the station, without so much courtesy as to slow down to 60 miles an hour. That's what the Tri-State Limited thought of your town. That's the kind of sound which Thomas Wolfe would write 7 chapters about. The kind which wakes you up at night with a dim recollection of something you did long ago, or somewhere you've been, or with a vague premonition of places you were going sometime, somehow. That's the sound of a night train. Busy, alone, in a hurry, unafraid of winds and darknesses and weathers. A sasserback at bridges and crossings. A whistler in the dark, but only out of fear of being late. There are more whistles in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy, Horatio. All kinds. Sober and romantic, utilitarian, ridiculous. Some sell a tropical plant known as the Arachis hypogaea. Some can stop excess motion in its tracks. Some are clowns and pratfall artists. Some are naturals at musical improvisation. Some are critical expressions of approval. And some are harbingers of death. Much for common sounds. But what of common silences? Do you protest? All silence is the same. It isn't, though. Not for the living. There's not a man alive who's ever heard complete and perfect silence. Not deaf men, for they hear hums and pulses. Not men shut up in silent rooms, for there's their own breathing and the beating of their hearts. The classic silence is, of course, the grave. For in the grave, as far as we know in our unmystical way, there are no worthy noises. All is a deep and ultimate silence, profound, inscrutable, surpassing anything the living ear can testify to having heard. But the silences we do know, the common silences, number almost as many as the common sounds. Each has a different time and place and character, a timbre even. What does a silent night in the country sound like? Listen. It's so peaceful in the country. But would it be so peaceful if your ear were capable of amplifying this alleged silence? Listen. There. You've heard what passes ordinarily for a quiet night in the country. Now there are certain kinds of silences known as welcome silences. An outstanding example is the one which follows the pulmonary exercises of the very young. Imagine a whole night of this. And you walk up and down saying, "Oh, baby, what's the matter, baby?" And finally the baby tires itself out and drops off to sleep. And the house is reclaimed by silence. That is known not only as the welcome silence, but as a welcome and stay a while, will you, silence. Another member of the silent family is that which occurs in the dentist's chair after extensive drilling, in the course of which the dentist asks you what you think of the world's situation. And you reply, "All I think of the world's situation." The drilling continues, sounding efficient and scientific to the outside ear, but resounding inside your own head like this. And then at length, at great length, at what is known as long last, the drilling stops. And the silence thereupon is one of the most welcome known to man. Now then, there are many more qualities of silence. There's the familiar, embarrassing silence which descends when you pull the faux pas, the awful blunder, the prize boner of all time. And then there's the eerie silence, chiefly found in ghost stories and unpleasant places. And then there are the twin favorites of writers, without which they'd be sorely handicapped, if not ruined. These are the tense silence and the electrifying silence. Whenever two or more people in a story or a play confront each other without speaking a word, just confront each other head on, well, that's a tense silence. Electrifying silences are very common in drama. And as an illustration of how these are put together, we'll perform a scene from an unproduced melodrama entitled How Quietly Sammy Runs. The scene is the interior of a rude cabin in a deep woods at night. It's pitch black outside, and only the flicker of an oil lamp lights the cabin, throwing long shadows against the wall. Our heroine, Pauline, played by Gail Thunderguard, is alone. Corduroy, the hero, played by Paul Muni, has gone to town to buy a gun to protect Pauline from a monster, played by Boris Karloff. Well, Pauline is walking up and down in the cabin. And suddenly, there's a knock on the door. That was the first of a series of four electrifying silences. Well, Pauline, her heart pounding with fear, goes to the door. She can't very well ask who's outside because Corduroy, the hero, lost his power of speech in a hunting accident 2 years ago, and so he can't answer anyway. So, taking a long chance and hoping for the best, she opens the door. That's the second electrifying silence. Pauline reacts to what she sees standing on the other side of the door. That's the third electrifying silence. And then, as the feeble lamp flickers in the wind from the open door,
That was the fourth and final electrifying sound. For those who insist on knowing what happened, let it be explained that it was, of course, the monster who knocked at Pauline's door, and that's why she screamed when she opened it. But just as he leered at her, the hero, Corduroy, showed up at the window, and quick like a fox, he emptied the barrel of the gun he had just bought. But his aim was bad, and he shot Pauline by mistake. That makes it a tragedy. Oh, but wait. The shock of having killed Pauline by mistake brings back Corduroy's power of eloquent speech, and thereby he succeeds in making the monster see the error of his ways. And the monster reforms, and he and Corduroy go into partnership. And once a year, they reverently lay a wreath on the grave of Pauline. If anybody wants this plot, he can have it, including the movie rights, for nothing. So much for electrifying silences. Now we must tell you about radio silence. Radio silence is the only kind which can cover so much ground and be in so many places at the same time. As a free sample, suppose we stop now for a few seconds and transmit only what is known as dead air. You have just heard silence racing around the world at the incredible speed of light. Silence cutting through the tangled ethers of the globe, straight into your living room. I hold my tongue a moment in Studio B, K-Station KNX, Sunset and Gower, Hollywood, California. And little whirlpools and eddies of silence play on every rooftop in America. An unexpected silence in the midst of any network program such as this would shock preoccupied technicians. Engineers in master control rooms around the country would look up in alarm. Standby organists, announcers, production men would jump to their feet or to a microphone, or both, thinking a line had failed, a link dropped out of the great chain, a wire in the circuit gone haywire. The silence is a strange and out-of-place phenomenon in such a talkative and busy channel of communication. Just how strange it is, you can gather for yourself from a simple illustration. Take a small quantity of dead air and place it where it doesn't quite belong. See what I mean? How long was that? 9 seconds. Long enough for a fast man to run 90 yards. For a fast plane to fly a mile. For a radio engineer to have a fit. 9 seconds don't seem long in casual pursuits. But in the radio studio, it amounts roughly to 40 years. I'm the one for whom that bell tolls. And it means that radio time is moving along at its usual rate, and that we'd better get on to our next subheading under the general title of The Anatomy of Sound. Our next subject, will you kindly hand me a subject out of that goldfish bowl, please, is Sound for a Poor Man's Vacation. This refers to a wonderful idea we have for a world cruise costing absolutely nothing, and therefore coming well within the price range of the poor man. It is a tour exclusively by sound, beginning in New York, where the poor man takes a cab at Times Square for Grand Central Station. It's one of those new type cabs in which you press a button and the window opens, and you press another and it closes. What's the world coming to when a man can't crank his own automobile window up and down? Well, at Grand Central Station, he boards a train for Buffalo. Grand Central Station has only electric locomotives, and they don't pant like this. But in an adventure story of this sort, certain allowances are made for a dramatic license. At length, our poor man arrives in Buffalo, where he visits Niagara Falls. And from Buffalo, he proceeds to Chicago, where he drops off at the stockyard to find out why he's paying so much for meat these days. And after a whiff of that, he goes to Albuquerque and sits in on some Indian dances. So then our poor man proceeds to Hollywood, where he has an uncle in the grocery business, and he takes a swim in his uncle's pool. And after that, he books passage for Hawaii. And on that handsome island, he visits the main volcano, Mauna Loa. After which, she goes to Australia. We're jumping in big jumps now because we haven't much time allowance for this excursion from the main subject. And besides, our poor man has to get back to work. In Australia, he listens raptly to the call of the Kookaburra bird. And the next thing you know, our traveler is in the Belgian Congo, observing some of the native rituals. And as evidence of how small the world is getting to be, he takes a super clipper from Cape Town and is back in New York riding the subways again and struggling for a living inside of 48 seconds. Now, you may have noticed that this treatise hasn't touched upon the matter of music, which certainly comes under the heading of sound. All of us in this whole wide, warring world of ours are much accompanied by music. The naivest ears, the mind that cannot carry but abort the simplest melody, the spirit most insensitive to song, meets music at the crossways. We are lulled by lullabies in childhood, and we fall in love with waltzes in our hearts. We marry to a wedding march and tramp away to war while drums beat and while bugles bray. And when we die, the music somewhat softens. A solemn sort of lullaby. A nocturne for the soul. An overture to nothing in particular. Oh, well. We have a platform regarding sound. Let it, like music, captivate the sense by metaphoric utterance, by mood stuff, and far-ranging concepts. Let us say things in terms of other things. Dissolve and modulate and set up new vibrations in the deepest chambers of imagination. Observe now. Here is a sound effect of a crowd. We are going to play it for you as it was recorded. Then slow it down and see what it becomes. People's voices blowing in a mighty chorus. A wind that can become a hurricane. A wind to topple tyrants, ripping out their gnarled and deep-spread roots. A wind of protest, of opinion, of determination. Or, listen to another crowd of people. Here, by changing speed, these voices become surf. Surf booming in the night, eternal, like the sea itself. Here's the heaving tide of all humanity, sweeping from pole to pole. Here reenacts the restless drama of renewal. Charge of waves and waves and waves and waves upon the planetary shore. There sounds a signal for the final phase concerning amplification. We are living, my good and far-flung friends, in the age of amplification. Practically everything today is amplified. The man who calls out numbers in the Beano concession. The auctioneer, giving away the beautiful, unbreakable fountain pen at less than cost. The keynoter at the political convention. The president in his inaugural. The sound truck on Main Street advertising the circus come to town. The counterman relaying orders to the kitchen. All sound can be amplified. Heartbeats can be made to sound like far-off drums in Africa. Here's still another specimen. A man bites some celery. It makes a little noise, but unless he's an exceptional biter or the celery is unusually crisp, you can't hear his chewing more than 2 feet away. Take an ordinary microphone, like the one I'm speaking through, and place it at this man's jaw, and you won't hear much, if anything. But put a little compact microphone against his cheek, and you'll get this. Now, if celery can sound like thunder, what can thunder sound like? A blast, no doubt, to shake down 27,000 stars from heaven. Man's amplifying ear will hear the respiration of the tadpole. Count dust motes as they knock against his pillow in the night. Wake in winter to the thud of snowflakes on the roof. The very air, when tranquil, will disclose new harmonies. The clash of kissing lips make towers totter, and suspension bridges sway like birches in the wind. Will truth be amplified one day? Will man's humanity to man make joyful noises, shouting down the tyrant's cannon? Will the hand clasp of two honest men be louder than the clink of hoarded gold? Will song and laughter roll unmitigated down the sound waves of the world? How soon, O engineers of man's society, before the grosser sounds are banished from the hearing of the race? The venal cluck of greed, the roar of despotism, and the bluster of the deadly braggart. Let bursting bombs crossfade eventually to choruses announcing victory. Let independence's cracked bell ring out again for all enslaved people. Let the groaning of the persecuted rise to shouts of jubilation, to the hallelujahs of a world made free. Let one decisive crash of thunder cleanse dissension earth.
You have been listening to Gail Sundergaard, distinguished actress of stage, screen, and radio, in The Anatomy of Sound, a new treatise for a solo voice, written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin as program number 18 in the Columbia Workshop cycle 26 by Corwin. Sound effects tonight were performed by Alfred Spann, assisted by Cliff Thorsness, Clark Casey, and Gene Twombly. The studio engineer was Gary Harris. The program originated in the studios of KNX Hollywood. Next week at this same time, the Columbia Workshop will present program number 19 of 26 by Corwin. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.